Well, good morning. I'm Jack Hafer, and some of you know me, but I stand amazed as I stand before you of how many people here I don't know. I was talking with my wife when we were driving up. When did I leave Kirkland? And it was somewhere in 78, 79. And so I have been gone from this area for 39, going on 40 years. And yeah, I look older, I know, but... And it's so wonderful, though, to see a lot of new people here. That means the church has continued to grow and it's vibrant. Nick and Crystal, my nephew and niece, they are part of this group. And would you let them know I'm a little upset with them that they chose to leave town? I'm afraid they didn't want to have their Uncle Jack over for dinner or something. But you let them know I'm just disappointed. No. And, but no, it is wonderful to be here. It's the first time I've come back to preach in those 39 years. So I consider it a privilege. The only downside is that Brent and his wife have to be gone for me to come because we enjoy visiting with them so much. They've been friends of ours, mostly with Ann for the longest time. She knew them while she was in Florida. And, tonight, I have to be back. I get to be back and continue a series of lessons we have in Salem. So we have to leave right after services and hit the road and get down there to Oregon. So we wish we could visit and be with you longer, but Lord willing, that could happen at another time. So with that being said, let's just talk about... a couple questions. When it comes to faith, the issue of faith, we see a lot of issues in our generation that I wouldn't say are new and peculiar to our generation, but yet they take different shapes and forms. And I'll just ask some questions to illustrate what we're talking about. How come we are losing so many of our children in this generation to the world? Surveys show that up to 58% of our youth, when they leave the home, they leave the faith. Why is that? That's a problem. Why is it that worship in the church can come across as being boring, or it feels like the church is dead? And we'll have something to say about that. The next question is, why are so many churches actually dying out? It depends on which survey you look at, and it's not just in the Lord's Church, but across the Christian community. We see churches in America, average size of 50 or smaller, and many are closing up their doors altogether. Now, why is that? Is there an answer that we can come to so we can resolve that and make sure that God's kingdom will continue? Now, we know it will. Because Jesus said when he said, upon this rock I'll build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail. We know the Lord's church is going to prevail. But that doesn't mean it will here. Doesn't mean it will in South Salem where I worship. It depends upon us understanding the task before us and then applying the Lord's wisdom to our life. And it really comes down to faith. Because faith... when kids leave the faith, I'll suggest maybe they didn't have a complete saving faith to start with. Because so often, faith, in a lot of people's minds, is just an academic thing. Or others, it's just this leap you take. One day you're not a believer, then all of a sudden you become a believer. Thus, you had a leap of faith. And we're going to see when you look at Scripture, though, that faith or discipleship encompasses your entire being. Is that not correct? Jesus says that in this text in Luke chapter 10, you shall love the Lord God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind. See, it's all encompassing our faith and discipleship in Jesus Christ. And yet, that's not what we see in the world so much. But we're going to show in this lesson this morning that faith has to start, yes, in the head. It's intellectual to start with, but it must move to your heart. And then finally, it must be demonstrated in your hand, in your actions, in what you do. And if we could do that, I think we'll see the solution to overcoming the demise of the church and our youth as we see in this generation. When we define faith by the world's term, we get a really problematic definition. First of all, Merriam-Webster says, yeah, it's allegiance or duty to a person. But when you look at the secondary definition, I want you to see that in number two there. It's a belief in traditional doctrines of religion. But here it is, firm belief. This is what the world defines faith as, something for which there is no proof. Isn't that sad? And that's the way the world views Christianity. You're believing in something which you can't prove. Just like the tooth fairy or Santa Claus or things of that sort. And so no wonder there's such an antagonistic attitude to Christians today that when we send our kids off to school, this is the type of attitude that they find about Christians and about themselves. It's the essence of faith to believe what you cannot prove. Or another writer, Newsom, said it's ambiguity is the essence of faith. You really don't know, and you really can't prove it. Even Luther said faith is the master, and reason, it's a maidservant. In other words, your faith drives your reason. I would suggest it's going to be the other way around. It's so bad that one of the most outspoken speakers today against Christianity, a self-proclaimed atheist, Richard Dawkins, here's what he says. Faith, he's talking about you and me. And if you're offended, that's okay. You ought to be offended. Faith is the great cop-out, the great excuse to evade the need to think and evaluate evidence. Faith is the belief in spite of, and perhaps because of, the lack of evidence. Now, does that characterize you? Is that the way you view your faith and understanding who God is and who Jesus is, his son? That's the way the world views Christianity. And these are the scientists and the academics to which we give our children over to so often when we send them to school, and then we let the colleges finish them off. And we wonder why we lose so many children. Well, we're going to throw that away and dismiss it because that is a delusion. It's a misrepresentation of what Christianity is all about. Because we're going to see that a true saving faith, it's always been something that starts intellectually in the head. But then it moves to the heart because there, this mental assent is taken over by this subjective trust. I trust God with my whole life because I understand who he is. So this faith convicts the mind as something is being true, but then it moves to the heart. And so I will do whatever you ask because I know mentally who you are. And then that type of trust is always illustrated or seen in our actions. And so it finally moves to the hand. So with that being said, let's move to the first thought, that faith has to start in the head. It's reasonable. It's objective. In fact, it's more reasonable to believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, than it is not. And it's only the person, perhaps, that has a closed mind that's not willing to consider the facts that says, no, he's not the Son of God, or God forbid, there is no God at all. The first misconception I want to consider you is faith is blind. Have you ever heard that? Faith is blind. That there is no evidence for any spiritual belief that you might have. Now, that's what much of the world believes, and the truth is really quite the opposite. Faith is a product of persuasion. And I just want to demonstrate that quickly, and we could spend another hour on it. And it's one of my favorite topics to talk about the reason behind our faith. But to do so, I want you to look with me, John chapter 10. This is a great passage where we see a dialogue between Jesus and the Jews of his days, of whom the audience he's speaking to are really not believers. So we find ourselves in John chapter 10 and verse 22. It's the Feast of Dedication that took place at Jerusalem. It's winter. Jesus is at in the portico of Solomon. This could hold thousands of people, this portico. In verse 24, we find the Jews therefore gathered around him, and they were saying to him, how long are you going to keep us in suspense? If you're the Christ, just tell us plainly. Now, that seems to be a fair enough question, doesn't it? Now, I'm going to ask you, though, do they really want to know? Because a lot of times people ask the right question, but their heart really is not into what they're asking. They're just trying to set up Jesus here. They really don't want to know the answer. You say, well, that's pretty judgmental. Well, as we read through this narrative, we find that's exactly the case. So verse 25, Jesus answered them, said, I told you. I told you who I was. We could go back and find the many places where he claimed to be the Christ, the Son of God. And they tried to stone him on those occasions. But he says, you don't believe me. Now, here we might saw him say, well, yeah, see, why should you believe a man just because he says he's the Son of God? But Jesus didn't stop there. He says, I told you, but the works that I do in my Father's name, they bear witness of me. Now, what works is he referring to? Miracles. When he walks on the water, when he heals someone, when he feeds 5,000, the reasonable person would go, wow, how did he do those things? That's why they're called signs, because they point somewhere. They point the mind. And miracles, because they're supernatural, and wonders. Why are there wonders? You go, whoa! You wonder, how did he do that? It's supernatural. He must not be a man. He must be a God. He says, my works spoke for me. And he said, really, the reason you don't believe, verse 26, is you're not of my sheep. But my sheep do hear my voice, and they follow me. And he says, I'm going to give them life. No one can snatch them from me or out of my Father's hand, because verse 30, I and the Father are one. And here again, he claims equality or being divine. Now get this, verse 31, so the Jews took up stones to stone him. So they didn't listen to anything he said. But here he's claiming to be divine, so that's blasphemy in their eyes, so they want to stone him. And I love what happens next. Jesus goes, wait a second. See, they got stones in their hand. Before you stone me, I just got one question. Which work, I showed you many of them from my Father, which of them are you going to stone me for? He's playing with, isn't he? Was it healing the lame man? Maybe it was casting out that demon. How about it was giving sight to that blind man? I just want to know, before you kill me, which miracle are you going to kill me for? What's he doing? He's trying to get them to think, to deal with the miracles that he performed. But they refused to do so. And they said, it wasn't for any good work. Do they choose to deny the miracles? No. They say, it's because you claim to be God, and that's blasphemy. Now, that takes us finally to verse 37. If I do not do the works of my Father, here's what Jesus is saying, don't believe me. Does Jesus want you to follow him blindly? No. Does he want you to have a faith based on reason and conviction and persuasion? Absolutely. He just tells you, just plain and simple, if I didn't do these miracles, if they were fake and they didn't take place, then don't believe me. My clicker fell, so I have a backup. Thank you, sir. Isn't that amazing? A miracle, a new clicker. All right. And then notice what he says in verse 38. But if I do them, though you do not believe me. See, he doesn't want you to listen to his word just because he claims it. Because a lot of people claim a lot of things. He says, don't believe me, but believe the works, the miracles, that you may know and understand the Father is in me and I in the Father. Is that not reasonable? To understand that Jesus Christ, based on evidence, not on just his words, his say-so. So he demonstrates the claims to be true. We find that not just here, but in John chapter 5, he said, the witness which I have is greater than that of John. The works which the Father has given me to accomplish, the very works, the miracles, they bear witness the Father sent me. Then in John 14, in verse 11, believe me that I am in the Father, Father me, but believe on account of the works themselves. I want you to see the language that is used throughout the New Testament. It's all about language of persuasion. And when you see that, it's just actually quite moving. The word faith in the Vines Dictionary is defined as this. It's firm persuasion, a conviction based upon hearing. It's used New Testament all as a faith. Faith doesn't say, I think. Faith does not say, I hope so. Faith says, I know. I know Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. Notice again the language we see throughout the book of the Gospels, and especially in the book of Acts. We see the word reason used there. We see the word argued. There was evidence given. Paul confounded the Jews. Persuaded is used 52 times. Look with me in Acts 17 as just one example, and I'll leave you to search out the rest on your own. Acts 17, Paul, as his custom, found himself in the synagogue when he went to a town. And that's in verse 2. And here's our first persuasion word. He went to them, and for three Sabbaths, he reasoned with them from the scriptures. Verse 3, explaining. Does this sound like some mystical leap of faith? Reasoning, explaining, and here's the next word, and giving evidence that Christ had to suffer and rise again from the dead, and saying, this Jesus who I'm proclaiming to you is the Christ. Verse 4, and some of them were persuaded. They were convicted. Now, that's interesting, the language there. Some were, that means what? Some won't. Some will, some won't. And we move on. And because the majority won't, does not mean that you're a fool for following Christ. Actually, it means the opposite. It's always been the minority. And we have to be confident in that, but yet the world would have us see it another way. This is Richard Lewontin. He's a pronounced self-proclaimed atheist, believer in evolution. This is a lengthy quote, but here is the attitude of scientists that trickles down into the science classes, not just of our colleges, but our high schools today. Not everywhere, but it's the predominant theme. So I want you to just read it with me. We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs. Does he acknowledge some of it's absurd? In spite of its failure to fulfill many of its extravagant promises of health and life, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories. Why? Why do we do this? Because we have a prior commitment, a commitment to materialism. Now, he's a naturalist, a materialist, and that means that there is no supernatural. It's not possible. Because we don't believe in a God. So even if I saw a miracle, I would think it has to have a natural cause. I just don't understand it yet. Everything has a natural cause and effect. That's his commitment. Now, is that a absolute or is that a leap of faith? When you have a commitment to naturalism, where's the evidence that everything has to have a cause and effect that's natural? So he says, it's not the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept it, a material explanation. See, we're not compelled by science. It's a choice. It's a belief system. But on the contrary, we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation, a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated, that's you and me. Moreover, that material is an absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot into the door. Isn't that amazing? They would come out and say it. The reason we believe, and I use that word intentionally, what we believe, because we don't want to acknowledge a God could exist, or even that possibility. We can't allow him in the door. Another writer we find, Richard Dickerson, he's a biologist. He says, science is fundamentally a game. I love the quotes that they give us. Sometimes their science is so far over my head, and I imagine you feel the same way. that I don't know half the time what they're talking about, even though I study and read a lot about it. But what's wonderful is we can use their quotes because they know and they tell us what's going on. And here's another one. It's a game with one really rule, overriding rule. Here's rule number one, the main rule. Let us see how far and to what extent we can explain the behavior of the physical and material universe in terms of purely physical and material cause without invoking the supernatural. In other words, do whatever it takes, come up with any far-fetched story or theory, but anything you can, just long as you never appeal to the spiritual. Now, is that close-minded? Does that take a leap of faith? Now, we can give it examples of that, but that's what our children hear. Doesn't matter which survey you look at. This was done in 2006. 73% of those in the United States believe there's a God and believe that Jesus is his son. Yet, when you look at those that actually worship him, a quarter of those same people, 25%, attend some type of worship service. There's a big disconnect between what people know mentally, maybe because they're really not persuaded. Maybe they just taken a leap. It's not a firm persuasion. But there's still a disconnect between what they know, or at least say they believe, and then what they actually do. And so the question is, what is missing? What's wrong? And here's where we need to go to our next point. Because faith starts in the head. And parents, you are the first line of defense between losing your children to the world and to Satan and keeping them in God's family. You have the responsibility, as my wife and I have, to raise up our children in such a way that they have a faith that's not just inherited from their families, not just indoctrinated to them by the church, but it's their own faith. And they have given reasonable evidence, and they have given firm persuasion that they can repeat and recite so they can say confidently, I know there is a God. I know Jesus is his son, and I know he is my Lord and my Christ. And if we don't do that and we send them out, well, that's how they get lost so quickly. Half of them are victims. Are prisoners of this spiritual warfare we are missing in action. Because it starts right here. We are the last line of defense, the church. We're for the youth. And then we have to give reasonable answers to reasonable questions. But those just make us think, that kind of evidence. And so we got thinkers in the church. Now we're going to have to move, and our faith has to move to our heart. Because here's the problem. A lot of people have good Bible knowledge. They can quote scripture, they can explain scripture, they've memorized scripture, but that's not a saving faith. Faith has to move from the head to the heart. So what are you talking about? That which can be empirically proven now has to move into a subjective reliance upon the one whom I believe in. It's called trust. See, the word trust in the New Testament often comes from the same Greek word we get faith from. Because faith has the idea of mental assent, but then once you believe it beyond a shadow of doubt, then you trust in that which you believe. I'll give you an example. Our daughter, Amy, a redhead, loves the outdoors. She lives in Fort Collins, Colorado. Loves climbing, and 2 weeks ago, she was climbing 14,000-foot peaks. On the way down, they encountered a gentleman who was in his 50s who was a doctor, and he was struggling because of the altitude sickness. And they walked with him for a while, but then he seemed to be okay. But a little farther down the path, her boyfriend saw him struggle. He put down his hiking pole. It snapped, and he went over into a collier and fell 1,000 feet to his death. Why do I tell a story like that? Because Amy told me just this last week, Dad, I've changed. I just think of all the things I've done out in the mountains that were stupid. Because accidents happen just that fast. And when you have rules about what you do and don't do. But when you think you're safe and you can never get hurt, you break those rules and you take chances, don't you? said, I'm not taking any more chances again. Because did she know the rules up here in her head? But what has happened to her because of that experience? They moved from her head now to her heart. It was an emotional, traumatic event. But she says, no, I'm going to be very safe now because I know it happens that quick. You see, that's what has to happen with our faith spiritually. That you come to a conclusion and moves from your head to your heart. And yes, that's emotional. Yes, it is. Everyone that encountered Jesus and was convicted truly who he was, you know what they all did without exception? They fell on their face before him. The Magi at his birth fell down and worshiped him. Peter, when he had that great catch of fish, he fell down before Christ and he said, depart from me, Lord, I'm a sinful man. We find that a man who was full of leprosy, he comes to Jesus and falls before him. He said, Lord, if you're willing, cleanse me. And Jesus said, I'm willing. The one I love is the woman who in a crowded venue, and there's people all around Jesus and bumping into him. She just reaches up and touches his garment. And Jesus said, someone touched me. And his disciples rebuking him said, what do you mean, Lord, someone touched you? People are bumping you all over. I felt strength go out from me. The woman, realizing that she's been discovered, comes before him and what? Falls down. And she said, Lord, I just knew if I could touch you, I could be healed. I have to ask the question, where did she get that idea that if she touched Jesus, she'd be healed? Did Jesus tell her that? Was that in the rule book, you know, of Christian faith? Touch Jesus' clothes, you get healed of your infirmities. Where did she get such a nonsensical, counterintuitive attitude? Because it started here, didn't it? If he can feed 5,000, if he can walk on the water, if he can restore sight to the blind, then he can heal me. I just gotta touch him. That's moving from the head to the heart. You say, well, that's subjective. Yes, it is subjective. It starts very objective, but it can get stuck in your throat, your faith. It's got to move here and take over your very person. Emotionally, you have to buy in 100% and bow before him and say, you are my Lord, and I trust you, and I'll do anything you ask of me. It's interesting, the three close friends of Jesus, Peter, James, and John, the Mount Transfiguration, when they saw him and they heard the voice from heaven said, this is my beloved son, hear ye him. He says again, they fell on their face. And I think that is what it takes to keep our youth and to keep us to being faithful. This is the difference between having a worship that is lively and spirited and one that seems to be dull and just traditional and full of ritual. It's when faith moves from your head to your heart. Now, that's what we see here, and we could give a lot of examples. Because the first thing, though, we have to understand, the misconception is that faith is just an intellectual process and is devoid of any emotion. And the reality is that faith, when convicted, a person passionately trusts Jesus. A lot of texts talk about this. We'll just go over them real quickly. Jesus, when his part, he was not entrusting himself to those his disciples, because he says he knew all men. The word trusting is faith. He didn't faith himself. He had mental sin. He said, yeah, I know they say they believe me, but I don't trust them. See, he's using that aspect of the word. John chapter 14, Jesus tells his 12 when he announces to him he's leaving. He said, let not your heart be troubled. That's agitated. He says, you believe in God, believe in me. He's not saying have mental assent. He's saying, you believe, but trust me. Trust me. I told you I'm going, and I'm going to promise you if I go, I'll return. And if I go, I'm going to prepare a place for you. And if I return, I'm going to take you to where I am. Now, how do I know that? How do you know there's a place in heaven for you? Did you see it? Did he send you a memo or a text? It's only because of his words, and I trust his words for just that. God, that he cannot lie, he's faithful, and so when he promises me a home, I believe it's true. So it moves the heart to trust him in everything that he asks him. It's this word of confidence or trust we find in Proverbs. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do not lean on all your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him. The psalmist writes it this way. As far as me, I trust in the Lord. And, oh, Lord, I say, thou art my God. My times are in thy hand. That is a very important verse. My times are under my control. That's not what he says. We have schedules, we have plan, and if we can't take control of our life and everything that happens, we feel like life's out of control and we're a mess. Not the person that trusts in the Lord. He says, my time, my hours, every second of my being is in your hand. I give it to you and I trust you that you're going to take care of me, direct my feet, because it's not in me to direct my own. I trust you. Because I know who you are, so I give myself over to you. John Piper writes it this way. The astonishing thing is people can become religious without being converted. That is, they join churches and start reading the Bible and do religious things with no change in the foundation of their happiness. It's still themselves. That's the foundation of their joy. They are the ground of their own joy. It's not Jesus. It hasn't moved from their head to their heart. Let us share Mark chapter 4, where Jesus is in the boat with his disciples. And we know the account that a great storm arose, and several of these men were seasoned fishermen. They'd been on the Sea of Galilee. And so when it says in verse 37, there's a fierce gale and winds were breaking over the boat and the boat was filling up. We know these men were scared because this is really serious. It's one of those storms you don't want to be in because you're going to die. And so we see in the text that Mark records that he himself, Jesus, was stern asleep on the cushion. Now, why is he asleep? There's only one answer. He's tired. And two, what? He has no care, no concern. Why? I created everything. I created the winds and the storms and the lakes. I have no problem. But they wake him up, and they have to wake him. And here's the question. It just has to cut at your heart because I've asked the same thing. Lord, don't you care? Don't you care that we're perishing? Do I care? I mean, if we knew Lord anything about him, we know one thing for sure, that he cares. Well, now, what causes the person to ask such a silly question? Because their faith is still in their head. It hasn't moved to their heart. So what does Jesus do? And this demonstrates what we're saying. And he, being aroused, he rebuked the wind and said to it, hush, be still. And the wind died down, and it became perfectly calm. And here it is. Why are you so timid? Looking into the disciples. And here it is. How is it you have no faith? Does he mean mental assent? Say no. What does he mean? Why don't you trust me? And I'm going to ask the same question of myself. When their life and we're full of anxiety and sleeplessness and we feel like our life is under control, we can hear the words of Jesus saying, why are you so timid? Why don't you have any faith? We're full of this academically. We said, how come it hasn't taken over your heart and your life? Now it says they became really scared. You know what it says? It said, who is this man? They were very much afraid. See, rather than being afraid of the storms of life, the only thing we should fear is Jesus Christ himself and the power that he can exhibit. And when I give my life to him, well, then I'm going to have life abundantly. Quite a text, isn't it? So when we look at that, we have the thinkers, but your faith has to move to your heart. And then we're going to have what we call the feelers. Now, when we talk about feelers, though, the problem is that when you trust him, you can't just have your faith locked in your heart, because a lot of people feel a lot about the Lord. But it has to move to your hand. There has to be some type of action. And so here's our third and final misconception about Christianity in the world, that faith is some one-time event that requires no obedience to Christ. We call it easy believing. It's a person thinking, just get your ticket punched, your ticket of faith. Now you have a ticket going to heaven, so you go back to your life and do whatever you want. We find that that's not the case at all. Discipleship means a learner. It's one that follows Christ. They follow Christ in order to become like Christ. And so whatever he does, we're going to do, because when we're fully convicted who Jesus is, we're going to willingly is the operative word here, believe him in anything he asks us to do. And so we can just look at a few things that we're familiar with, but I just remind them, I'm not telling you anything new. Luke chapter 6, Jesus, you could hear the frustration in his voice when he says, why do you call me Lord, Lord? And don't do what I say, because Lord is saying, I acknowledge you are my master, but I'm not going to obey you. Is there a contradiction in that? Again, a lot of people claim they love him from his heart. And he says, not everyone who says, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but it's who does the will of my Father. And so we have to understand that faith or action, well, look with me in Luke 17. This will be your last text, or the important text I want you to see. Luke 17. It was dealt with briefly by Jim and his class on patience this morning. He tells them in Luke 17 and verse 4 that you're supposed to forgive someone 7 times if they come to you 7 times a day. And the apostles, I can hear them in unison in verse 5. Lord, increase our faith. That's a great prayer, isn't it? The Lord, increase my faith. All right? But Jesus comes back and says, wait a second. If you had just the faith of a mustard seed, the tiniest amount of faith, you could say to this this tree, be uprooted and be planted in the sea, and it would obey you. The mulberry tree, right. But then he switches gear. He said, it's really not about faith. Because verse 7, which of you, having a slave, plowing or tending sheep, will say to him when he's coming from the field, come immediately, sit down and eat? No. Verse 8, you're going to say to him, prepare something for me to eat, and properly clothe yourself, serve me until I've eaten and drank, and afterwards you will eat and drink. He does not thank the slave because he did the things which he was commanded, does he? So too, when you do all the things which you are commanded, you say, we're just unworthy slaves. We have done only that which we ought to have done. Here's my question for you. He startles them with the statement, when someone wrongs you and 7 times in one day, you forgive them 7 times. They're going, Lord, we need more faith. He says, no. If you had a little faith, you could do amazing things. The problem is, why does he tell this weird, different story? It doesn't seem to follow the chain of thought, does it? About servants and a master. He says, they don't come home and eat themselves. They prepare something for their master. Then after everything's done, then they feed themselves. And then afterwards, they just say, we're unworthy slaves. What he's trying to get us to see, when we fail to obey what Jesus asks us to do, specifically here, forgive 7 times, it's not a faith issue, it's a lordship issue. We do not regard Christ as Lord of our life, because if we did, when he said, forgive 7 times, we'd say, yes, Lord, I'm an unworthy slave, I'll just do what you ask. And none of this increased my faith, because yeah, you have mental ascent, but if you add more and more mental ascent, it won't help you. You've got to let what you know sink to your heart and then finally exercise itself in your hand and obey. It's a lordship issue. You see what I'm saying? Everything that Christ asks us to do, we do it out of willingness because we are convicted in our head and we trust him in our heart, and we do it, not because I have to. There's not grudgingly. It's not like I gotta go to worship, I want to. It's a lordship issue. Prove yourselves, James says, to be a doer of the word, not hearers who delude themselves. Of course, then he says, faith without works is dead. And Jesus said, if you love me, you're gonna keep my commandments. And so we're reminded of Peter. The second time when they're on the boat in a storm and they see Jesus coming and they don't know it's Jesus. And so they're much afraid. And he said, don't be afraid, it is I. In other words, have trust in who you know me to be, it's okay. And gotta love Peter's response. He said, Lord, if it is you, here's the word, command me to walk on the water. He didn't say, let me, command me. See, he understands the lordship of Christ. And he says, before I move my feet, I need to hear your command because I'm submitting to you. And if you don't tell me to, I'm gonna sink. But if you tell me to, I know I can walk. Is that true? A lot of faith? And the Lord said one word, what? Come. Now, I understand those boats are about this high, so he had to walk, move his foot over the edge of the boat. Can you imagine how fearful or maybe exciting that would be? And when he stepped over in the water, I always wondered, did his feet stay on the very top? Was there enough surface tension that he was on the exact top, or did it sink down like 2 or 3 inches? I don't know. But he steps out and everybody in the boat's going, no, don't do it, Peter. It's stupid. This is counterintuitive. It makes no physical sense, but it makes all the spiritual sense in the world, doesn't it? Because he said what? Come. He gets out and he walks on the water. And he's walking towards him. And then what does he do? Takes his eyes off just for a moment. Looks at the waves and goes, this is stupid. Guys can't walk on the water. What am I doing? And he sinks. And what does Jesus do? Reaches out, saves him. And here are the words. Oh, ye of what? Little faith. See, faith starts in the head. Makes all the sense in the world. Then it moves into the heart, and sometimes the Lord asks us to do things we don't understand. They don't make physical sense. They don't make financial sense. They don't make sense when it comes to relationships or marriage. They don't make moral sense. But when we trust him as the creator of all things, our Lord and our Christ, they make all the spiritual sense in the world, and I will gladly do what you ask me. See, that's a saving faith. And it's based on conviction that moves from the head to the heart to the hand. Now, much more to say about this, but time escapes us. So, I won't even tell you about Aaron Ralston. Okay, I will. Utah, 2003, search and rescue member. He knows the outdoors. He knows all the rules. One day, he decided to go out and broke his cardinal rule. He didn't tell someone where he's going. He's climbing in a slot canyon. You know what a slot canyon is? And this boulder that's dislodged, it's in the canyon, it's lodged in the wall, but it moves when he's climbing on it. It pins his arms between the wall and the boulder. And he tries to move it for 4 days, and he runs out of food. He just had a couple bars and some water. And the fifth day, he realized no one knows where he is because he didn't tell anyone. He's going to die. He knew the rules. He understood what now he had to do to save his life, but could he get his hand to do it? You know what he did? He forcefully broke his arm by throwing all his weight against the rock that, and the arm that's dislodged or lodged between that and the wall. And when it snapped in two, he took out his all-in-one purpose knife and cut his arm off. Then, having put a tourniquet around it, his belt, he walked out to his bicycle and biked out to the road until someone found him. Now, could you do that if your life was at stake? I don't know. Isn't that what Jesus will ask us to do? He says, I don't want you dead, though. I want you to present yourself as a living sacrifice. It's your reasonable work of service. And that's what I want you to do. Work out your salvation with fear and trembling. There's no group salvation. It's individual. And we got to hang on to our death. Now, here we're done. So now we got three groups. There's thinkers and feelers, and now we got doers. And we understand that each three deals with a different part of our person. And Jesus said, your faith has to involve your whole being, loving with all your heart, mind, and soul, and strength. So we have this mental ascent, and it starts in the head. And that's actually, I'm sorry, this intellectual should be over there. I had the wrong fonts. It didn't transfer. But that's intellectual, isn't it? And then it moves to the heart, and that's emotional. And then finally, it moves to the hand, and that's a matter of the will or volitional. You with me on that? So when we look at those three things, that's what we're dealing with here. That's what it means to love the heart, the Lord with all your heart, mind, and soul. Now here in every congregation, you're going to have people that are good on one of these things or the other. They're in this congregation thinkers. I already know a couple of them. Do you know who they are? They're very analytical. They're thinkers, and they can quote scripture, they can break it down, they can study it, and they're very, very good at it. Then there are people that are feelers. You know the type. Just a lot of emotion. They're all just emotional. And then there are people, they're doers. Often they're the backbone of the church. They get things done. Now, there's a problem between the thinkers and the feelers and the doers because often they resent each other. Isn't that right? The thinkers, they want to think. And they look at the feelers and say, oh, man, all you guys want to do is talk in emotion. You don't think things out. Would you just listen to them? There's often a resentment. And the feelers go, you guys are just cold and just sterile. You ought to have a little more emotion. You know, get with it. And then there's the doers. They just do. And sometimes they don't even think. And they're looking at the thinkers and saying, you guys, every time there's something needs to be done, you call for a committee. And then you plan it out. And after 3-4 weeks or months of study, you say, we're going to do this. We would have the job done by now. And so they don't like either the feelers or the thinkers. Is that not true in every congregation? And we have to learn not to resent them, but to value them. Because some people excel in the cognitive and their understanding of scriptures. But likewise, don't you resent those who are more emotional. Because emotion, it's the energy that moves the church. It's the lifeblood sometimes. It keeps us going and keeps us giving the energy when things get low. It's those kind of people that say, I don't know if it makes sense and I can't give you an answer why, but I know if we trust the Lord, it's going to work out. Do we need those kind of people in the congregation? But then you need the doers. Now, they need to listen to the thinkers and do it this way and don't act without thinking. And they need to have a little more emotion in their hand because it's not just a matter of legalism, but boy, they're the people that get the work done. So we nurture all three. We don't resent. We embrace. And we try to become a little bit of each ourselves. A thinker, a feeler, and Lord willing, a doer. There's our lesson. I hope it helps. Because our faith, when it moves from the head to the heart to the hand, we won't lose our children. Well, a lot less of them. Congregations will not die. And worship certainly won't be boring. When we employ these things and become true disciples of Christ, can you imagine what we can do for this community? I am so thankful that this congregation exists in the Seattle area, and I'm so thankful for the privilege to be able to speak to you after these 39 years. Hopefully it won't be that long next time. But thank you, and let's just continue on in the work of faith.